Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everybody, welcome to Mr. McEnroe over here and Mr. Boris Becker said, the infamous vodcast from Roland Garros in 2019. This year, this time, we're going to cover and try to sort of rank the Grand Slam tournaments. And I have a feeling which one comes as number one for too. But anyway, we're going to get to that. So first, I want to ask you about Roland Garros as we are here. Sometimes the stadium is not full. Sometimes there is hardly a soul in the arena. John, what's your feeling about the French tennis fan not showing up for the whole day sitting in their seat?
Well, I've got to just preface by saying that I think the French fan generally loves tennis. So I think we have to do a better job of managing expectations and sort of, you know, when you go to a restaurant, they try to make you feel comfortable and make you feel like at home in a way, and you feel special. And I think that we have to do that with the fans. The players obviously want to feel it. So whenever you have a match, it starts at 11 o'clock. To me, that's going to be a problem. You know, very rarely you're going to have a crowd full. So that has to be taken in consideration. I remember the one time that I thought that Sanga was going to get to the finals of the French. He played after the, I believe it was Rafa and Novak played the long match. And then there was a break. And I think it's understandable for the fans that they would need some time to sort of regroup, go to the bathroom, have a drink, get some food. And the players not knowing when the first match is going to end would lead me to believe it would be like, okay, 30 minutes after the match ends, that's when the next one will start. That way you give everyone a chance to regroup, and they don't do that. So then there was no energy. I remember in the crowd it was half full, and he lost the first set, ended up losing the match, and he said he was really disappointed that it was that way in the beginning. So I think that everyone has to work together and make it not feel like, oh, the crowd doesn't care. Because actually, I think in a way, French fans care more than most fans that I see in the sport.
Boris?
Well, a lot has to do with the French culture. I find the court this year side is busier than the last couple of years. Every morning there's a long queue when they come into Roland Garros. It's just the French like to have their lunch. And that takes a little bit. It doesn't matter who plays. So I think we have to take that into consideration. You know, you can't change the French culture, the French mentality. I'm with you, John, that once they're here, they're probably the loudest fans in the world. Not always for the right or the wrong, but they're just loud. They enjoy to express themselves. But I think tennis at around noon is difficult in France because of the culture and the way they go about their days.
There's another solution, which they do in a lot of award ceremonies, like the Academy Awards. And you understand that that is a long show, and that at some point, even the big stars or whoever they may be in the first few rows leave to go maybe get a drink, go to the bathroom, get something to eat. They have seat fillers. Now, to me, you have a lot of people that can't afford maybe to come to an event like this that would love the opportunity, even if it were only for a half hour, an hour, while some other people were having lunch, to fill the seats and have this opportunity to see the sport of tennis up close. I think that would be sort of a no-brainer. It would be like a win-win. I mean, it would take some organization, but I'm sure there'd be hundreds, if not thousands, of people, like they do to some extent at Wimbledon, queuing for the opportunity to come later in the day. I mean, think about it. On the main courts, you have four matches being played. usually it's going to be at least two men's matches where best of five. So if you figure you're not going to assume any fan alive, no matter how big a tennis fan, is going to sit there from 11 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock at night. So you have to sort of massage the situation a little bit and understand that there's going to be times where some people are going to come and go, but you can make up for that, I think, and filling, you know, seat fillers would be a great idea, no,
but,
I think.
But they have to deal with that problem because it just doesn't look good.
No, the upper tiers are usually pretty full.
Yeah.
It's just the bottom, the lunch goers, like you're saying, that choose to not go.
But I think you have to deal with the situation.
Absolutely.
It's not going to change next year. You're not going to change the French mentality. So you have to find a solution now already. Who are you going to put in between 11 and 2 o'clock? By put 2:30 around, it's full, and then by 5, it's packed. Great. But players are starting at 11. You know, you have great matches now on Philippe Chatrier, so you have to find a solution, as John said, to fill the seats with people that love to be here, but they never have a chance to get to see this match on center court.
And other shows, like TV shows, live shows where they talk shows, for example, even, this is not just those, but they have comedians that come out before and they sort of warm up the crowd.
Yep.
And so there's a way to do even something like that in between the matches. You could entertain them. If they want to stay and watch a little music, they could do that. There's all types of things that could be done. You could have a couple juniors come on the court. Now, they would be understandable if a lot of people left then, but just a way to sort of interact more and fill some time when necessary, and then build up the energy for the crowd. Because to me, that's part of why I believe there should be no warm-up, because I think it'd be more exciting for tennis if they came out and they introduced the players. They said, here's Boris Becker. You know, he's won Wimbledon 3 times, in the U.S. Open 2 times, in Australia. And here's Mats Wilander. He's won 7 Grand Slams, 3 French Opens, 3 Australians at a U.S. Open, and build it up. And so there'd be excitement. Mm. And then they toss the coin, and then they play. You've got 2 fighters going on in a ring, trying to knock each other's heads off. They don't sit there and warm up for 5 minutes. I mean, why is it that we need to do that? I just think that would be an example where people would be more energized.
So obviously then now we're onto a bit of innovation. No tiebreaker at Roland Garros. You want to see them knock their head off each other with no tiebreaker. That sometimes takes too long. I know you're for the tiebreaker. Why are they waiting here? What do you think? Just to be different?
Yeah.
Well, we keep talking about the French mentality and culture there a little bit. I think it was a good decision by Wimbledon, for example, because the matches just got too long. And a big server I don't want to mention is not too much, but he's the reason why this change of scoring at the end of the fifth set was implemented this year. The question is when? Is it 6-all? Is it 9-all? Is it 12-all? Now, we haven't seen that many super long matches going into late in the fifth set at the French. Last night we saw one with Herbert and Per, which I thought was the best match of the French Open so far. It was 11-9, so that was acceptable. But I think they have to find a rule here as well. And if it's 6-all, why not play tiebreaker? I mean, they already played for 4 hours at least, and, you know, it's... They still have to play more matches than there's the next day. So 6-all, I think a tiebreak at the fifth set is a fair solution for everybody.
I don't know why it's not the same at all the tournaments, why it's 12-all at Wimbledon. And
should it be the same, you reckon?
I think it should be the same. 6-all, especially here, which I think you certainly could argue is more physical than any of the other three. So why is it that here there's no tiebreaker?
Because here there's no roof. Doesn't go hand in hand, does it?
I'm not sure that follows, but
no. They're just late bloomers here at the Roland Garros. It seems they're the last facility to upgrade their facilities. I mean, they still don't have a roof, so.
Well, politics gets in the way of a lot of this stuff, and tradition is good in certain ways. But I think that we've all realized that being able to have a roof or two, I mean, all three of them have two now. You know, I was just over at Wimbledon. They just have their second roof ready on court one. So the idea that they don't have one here at all. Now, I know that things are different. When it rains, it dries. You can get on the court. But to me, it's always been a no-brainer. I always believe that there actually should have been a major somewhere indoors. Mm. I think that would have been interesting. So, that was the that was a pipe dream.
And think about the crowd. We spoke about that in the afternoon. They come. Think about a night session at the French Open in Chartrier. I mean, packed. Think of, you know, Songa or Monfils or, you know, some of these French guys come out at 8 o'clock. You know, would be the match of the day. So I think it would work in so many ways. And then, you know, you still have to fill up the stands at 11, 12 o'clock in the morning.
Mm. Maybe start later. You see, you could have less matches. You could just have two or three. And then they're going to have a night session. They've already said that next year they're going to have night sessions. So that's going to add some electricity. And the French like to have a good time, as they do in New York, and maybe more so than the other ones. But they're going to be ready to go. They're going to, you know, be the end of it, a work day, maybe have a couple drinks, have some food. They're going to be ready to get behind these players. So it's a long time coming, but you'll see they're going to love it.
I'm interested in knowing, because in the past when we played in the 80s, well, you guys played, Boris played some in the 90s. Did you play in the 90s?
I played a couple years.
It was obvious that the players that won here at Roland Garros was a defensive game. It was a matter of keeping the ball in play, and if you had a chance, you might do something. And obviously Wimbledon, with serving and volleying, was by far the most aggressive tactical. What do we think today when you compare Roland Garros to, let's say, Wimbledon? Because here you have to construct points and be very aggressive because of the way that the guys and the girls are hitting the ball. Whereas at Wimbledon, yes, you have to be aggressive, but it's not as natural. You're not coming forwards as much. There's a lot of slice backhands going on at Wimbledon from the baseline these days. The mindset is completely turned, or has it not?
Well, I think that to me, they don't change their styles from grass to clay and even hard courts.
And
to
is
me,
that bad?
Well, I think it'd be more interesting to see more variety where they had to switch gears. I think that players had to think on their feet more and adjust. And I think it's more interesting to see players having to deal with more adversity. So I think that the best players, obviously, have been able to add more to the game, but it's not as if Federer plays completely different, or Nadal, or any of the top players suddenly decide they're serving and volleying. Mm. I think Roger made the biggest change and was the most interesting to me when they quickened the courts a few years ago in Australia, which allowed him to sort of take balls earlier, be more aggressive, and feel more confident he could come in more. So I think down the road, to me personally, it's like watching a righty and lefty play. Just it's sort of, you're like, oh, okay, they're automatically different. And then if you see a two-hander versus a one-hander, and then if you see a guy that's going to be more aggressive as opposed to someone who's just staying back and counterpunching, that seems to be the most interesting to me. But the way the game's set up with the court surfaces, they're too similar to have that happen.
Mm. I think the game has changed. I think, in a way, it got more one-dimensional. Everybody, especially from the young players, plays kind of similar. They have good ground strokes. They're physically strong. They get into those rallies, and then whoever overhits or overruns the other guy would win. It's not necessarily who outplays the other guy. And they use the same style on all surfaces. That's why on grass, you see a lot of baseliners, you know, successful, and you see on clay. Yes, the all defensive game has changed on clay, but still, the guy that makes less mistakes usually wins at Roland Garros. So Wimbledon is still the opposite. But I would see, you know, and it would be maybe speed up their evolution a little bit from some of these 19-20-year-olds, that they add more elegant elements to your game, become more than just a one-dimensional A type of player, because you see Roger's change over the years. Rafa is playing more aggressive, and Novak is playing different than he's played 5 years ago, and that's the reason they're still on top of the game. And I think there should be a lesson for all the young superstars out there, that in order to want to be a complete player and to want to win a Grand Slam, you got to add more elements to your game.
Yeah. I think Tsitsipas has done that better than any player, because he's been unafraid. Yeah. He's switched gears. He's moved forward, come into net a lot more, and that's part of why I think he's had the success he's had so far, part of why he's so appealing. I mean, he's got all the qualities. He's got the looks, the hair, the the style of play.
Even the name, I find. It's Tsitsipas.
The name is a good name. It's all good.
Just for, there might be some younger viewers or listeners, just to clarify something here. So, and I'm going to answer it first. I come from the French Open, Roland Garros, and I haven't served and volleyed maybe more than once in 50 serves. And I go to Wimbledon, and I serve and volley 95% of the time on my first serve and 80% of the time on my second serve. John, what's your ratio of serving and volleying while you play Roland Garros compared to then going onto the grass just a week later at Queens, for example?
I would say that the first serve would be similar. You know, if I hit a good first serve, it was coming in. Second, I probably went in maybe less than half the time, you know, maybe a third of the time.
At Roland Garros.
Yeah. At Wimbledon, the way the courts used to be, virtually all the time, first and second serve. U.S. Open a little different, maybe I would say almost all the time on the first, but maybe two-thirds of the time on the second, you know, depending on the speed of the court. But it's changed quite a bit. It would be far tougher proposition with the way players return now.
Sure. I mean, I remember your match in 1984, and you know, I have to bring that up.
But
that was the best time you've played here. And I remember you coming to the net pretty much on every serve. I mean, you were chipping and charging because nobody played like that on clay. And I think, you know, question mark Roger Federer. He plays a style nobody plays here on clay. Nobody likes to play. The quick points, the change of rhythm. And that's one of the reasons he's still so successful, because he plays, in a way, an old-school type of game. I was in the middle between the two of you. I would come more to the net than you, Mats, but probably less than you, John. And on the surfaces, it was similar.
Nick Kyrgios has been a topic, but not really him personally. Players not playing all four slams. How do we feel about that? Nick Kyrgios has his reasons for not playing. Roger Federer had his reasons maybe for not playing, but is it okay to miss a slam? I mean, you're on tour, you're playing, you're ranked highly, you're on the ATP tour, you're supporting the game. The game has given you, I think, way more than you can ever give back to the game. Can we pick and choose which slam we play depending on if they're competitive enough to win it?
Well, I mean, this is something that's been talked about since I first came up. You know, who has control over player schedules? Who knows best for the player what he needs to do to max out and peak? And the way it used to be, it was more difficult to play the French and Wimbledon successfully, given there was only 2 weeks.
Yeah.
For an American coming over to Europe, I mean, these are great cities, Rome, Madrid, Barcelona. However, the amount of time spent away from your home in the States, that wears on you. You can't be away all the time. So you'd have to make a decision and compromise. And, you know, ultimately, I'm a sort of free trader in a way. To me, it should be like the player should be able to make their schedule. And if they decide they're, for whatever reason, they're not going to be able to go and give their best or perform at their best, or they prefer to try to be ready for a Wimbledon as opposed to a French Open, I think they should be given that right. I don't think they should automatically be, you know, that they there should be a penalty, that you should be automatically given like a zero pointer as if you lost first round. I think that's too harsh. I get your side of it, where, you know, they try to make a schedule, you needed to support certain events, or they want you to, you know, what is the minimum amount of events that a player should play a year? I mean, that obviously depends on the player. How big a family does it have? How old is that person? Can they, how taxing is that on them physically? So all these things come into play. And why is it that certain tournaments you have to play and other ones you don't have to play? I mean, it's, you know, so you get into the politics again.
I think it's the exceptions that players don't want to play the Grand Slams. There are reasons for us. Back in our days, most of us hardly played the Australian Open because it was in December, it was the end of the year, people were tired, so they weren't even going. So again, going with the statistics, who won most slams? You know, 70s and 80s, a lot of people don't even play the Australian Open. Only, say, in the last 20 years, it became such a great tournament and put at the beginning of the year, that's why everybody wanted to play. But let's talk about the names. Kyrgios doesn't play here because he thinks Roland Garros sucks. Anderson doesn't play here because he's still a bit injured, and I'm sure he's warming up for the grass as we speak. John Isner is not playing here because I think he's injured. He got a stress fracture. So there are reasons, and I'm with John on that. They are, you know, it's their choice, it's their career, and their responsibility ultimately. I think it, in my opinion, would be foolish not to play because you get a lot of prize money here and points, and it's just a great way to improve your tennis skills. But ultimately, it's for the individual to decide what's best for him, because when he's 35, nobody's going to ask him, you should have done that, you should have done this. You know, the career is over, and you have to do the most of it.
Roger didn't play for 4 years.
Yeah.
He chose after having come back a couple years, not to play the clay court season, because he's felt his best opportunity was to prepare for the Wimbledon. Everyone understood that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can't criticize that, right? I mean, you'd want him to play. He's
of course
the greatest, right? Yep. But you understood it. Now everyone said, well, this is great. He's decided to play. And obviously, you can see the crowds. There's an energy and there's a boost to the tournament because he's playing. And ultimately, he's been an unbelievably amazing for the game. He's tried to support all different levels of tournaments, you know, more so than probably any other player, and been involved in the politics. There's only so much, you know, a single person can take, and it, you know, there's a lot of things going on that factor into this. Boris mentioned Australia. I mean, it's a crapshoot to come in the beginning of the year in a way and have to go look at the players. Do a lot of them go 2 to 4 weeks before the tournament, so they have to be in Australia for an extended period of time. Now, there's a lot of – it's a great place to be, but, you know, the commitment year after year, I don't think you should be able to criticize the players just because they may decide one time. Kyrgios may not play here because he just doesn't think he's going to win here much.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably the real reason he's not playing. There were times in my career, do I wish I had – played Australia more? Yes. Do I wish I had prepared better for the French? Yes. When you're making your own decisions, sometimes you don't make the right ones, and then other times it feels overwhelming anyway.
Yeah, no. I mean, times have changed so much as well, so we can't really compare to what we did compared to somebody like Roger Federer, who's got his own foundation. He's building schools in Africa. So I think players today, they're building up these responsibilities that go outside of themselves making decisions just because they don't want it. Because if you are relying on people sort of buying your gear and your hats and whatever, and that's the income that you're building schools for, and suddenly you decide not to go, you also have to think of the other side, because you choose to be in that situation and suddenly somebody else is suffering for your decisions. But it's a different, it's completely different from
when
we.
Wow, you put even a lot more pressure on him.
Well, I'm just saying it's a lot different. I remember you and I, John, we played an exhibition tour in America, and we dropped, the plane dropped you off in Long Island, and you said, you waved and you said bye, and then you popped your head back in and said, and by the way, I'm taking 6 months off. I'm like, oh, okay, see you in 6 months. There wasn't anyone sort of saying, oh, John, you can't do that, or that's not good for the game, or you shouldn't do it. There's nobody around
you. Didn't hear the conversations with my parents.
But you
what?
You didn't have a whole...
You're taking 6 months off to have a kid? Are you crazy?
But they have a team around them. It's a different times for sure. I'm so... again, onto maybe not Roger's case at all, but in terms of physical fatigue... Is clay courts the worst surface for physical fatigue? In a way, it is, because the matches are longer. We always say it's so grueling to play on clay, and I'm like, well, not really. To me, hard courts was more grueling because there was more stop and start, and it was worse for your joints. What's your take on physically, Boris?
Well, let's see, where are the clay court tournaments these days? Rome is usually sunny, and then it's played pretty quick. Madrid, altitude. It's very quick. I mean, we both would have loved to play in Madrid.
Yeah.
The seven volley and the kick. Barcelona, Monte Carlo, I call that the typical clay courts, grinding, you know, 2-3 hours every match. But even the French, on a sunny day, you know, with the harder surface, I find it's pretty quick. So I think altogether the game has sped up on clay. Where on grass, it got a lot slower. Now, I think that's good. Because it's a bit more exciting if there's more speed and more action.
Are you saying that every time we played here at the French Open, it was raining?
It was raining and slow. It was impossible.
Right now, it's cold. Yeah. You know, and so it's slower, but it's less taxing in a way if it's 90 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's unpredictable. But I bet you if you looked, studied and went back 30, 40 years, the length of a rally, I'm almost positive it would be a whole lot shorter now. You know, they're going for so much more so quickly. More points end on the first couple shots, even on clay, way more than they used to.
Yeah.
So I don't think it – I mean, while it's still extremely physical because you need explosion because the first step's so important, I don't think you have as – maybe that's why they think that you don't have to play a tiebreaker. Yeah. I don't know.
Just take the example of Nadal, how his game has evolved. When he won, he has a 19-year-old, and he came to the net to shake hands. I mean, he kicked his first serve in, stepped around, and here we go with the forehand. Now I see Nadal as an aggressive baseliner, you know, coming to the net. The serve has improved, even speeding up his points. He's winning here in an hour and 35, 40 minutes. Yeah, the score was easy, but back in the day, 1, 2, and 3 lasted him 2.5 hours because of the structure of the ball. So even the greatest of them all on clay is speeding up his game because that's a sign of the time.
Another sign of the time is the facilities have improved so much over the years. What do we think? Are they competing with one another, these Grand Slams, for big time?
Yeah.
And have they sort of leveled out the playing field or are getting close to it now with Roland Garros improving the Philippe Chatrier, putting roofs on there? And then, of course, Australian Open has taken. Is it more even now between the four than, let's say, in the 80s, where I have a feeling you guys would say Wimbledon was maybe number one. You would most probably up in the air with the US Open, Wimbledon.
Are they more even today than ever before? I would say they're more even than ever before. I think Australia made a lot of renovations and changes sooner out of necessity because it just wasn't happening for them. You know, they weren't getting all the players, which was a great move. Moving away from where they used to play at Kooyong on grass to the new facility, which is they've turned into a whole entertainment center. It's not even tennis. And the French always has this great tradition. And will always be this tremendous event. But for someone in the States, it's not as important as Wimbledon, which is sort of Augusta, you know, the Masters of golf, or it's far away, unbelievable place. And me being from New York, the U.S. Open, and I mean, I'm biased, but I think it's the best city in the world. And so
only a New Yorker can say
New York, that. And there's something incredible, the energy there. So I think the other ones have worked hard to catch up and they're closer, but it's hard for me to think that Wimbledon, the Open, they're just something about they've always had an edge in my book.
But I think it all started with Australia. I think they changed the rule book. They wanted to become important. They wanted to matter, and they were the first one with the roof. And they were the first one with you know, spacious facilities for players, coaches, and everybody else, to the point where it's probably the most popular Grand Slam of all of four. Is everybody's looking to come to Melbourne beginning of the year because of the infrastructure and the facilities and the way they have included the night session. You know, in New York had it for us, but with the roof there, I mean, it's a great match. You know, 8 o'clock on Rod Laver, it's just a match you want to go to and see. And I think because of that, everybody else stepped up on the plate. Wimbledon was the second one with the roof. You know, that took a long time. And then in New York, which I thought was an impossible scenario, building on Louis Armstrong a roof. I mean, it's the biggest court in the world. I don't know how they've done it. So a night session in New York is magic. Yeah. I mean, that's why you want to play tennis. Yeah. And now the French have to follow. Yes, I respect their culture and the mentality, and the facilities are great. I think they've done a great job improving everything, but now they need the goddamn roof.
guys, thank you. I'm going to ask you one single thing because I've got a couple of French Opens to spare.
Yeah.
I don't need. I just need
you
one.
Can give me one.
Would you give? If I give you a French Open, would you slide me one of your Wimbledon titles?
I would quickly.
Would you do that?
Quickly.
You would do that.
Here we do.
I'll take one of each. Thank you, guys.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.